Hello, and welcome to the Tip of the Iceberg podcast. I'm your host, Amy Souter, with Produce Market Guide and The Packer, two trade publications in the fresh produce industry. This week, we talk with John Purcell, CEO and President of Unfold, a seed genetics company launched in 2020 to help specifically vertical indoor farms. Seeds for these farms have different needs with such tight, controlled environments. Plus, whatever can be done to keep costs down with all those upfront infrastructure costs and energy expenditures, I'm sure is welcome. We'll learn how retailers are responding and what vertically grown products besides leafy greens are most likely to appear on store shelves next. Let's hear the details straight from John.
Welcome.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you for the time. We're looking forward to the conversation.
So we know you're a seed company, I guess, categorized as a startup. There's some specialty in vertical farming seeds and all the innovations happening with that. Why don't you share some basics about Unfold?
Sure. So I think what we're trying to do is as we look at the vertical farming sector, there's been a couple $1 billion plus invested in it. But the majority of the investments have really been on the farms, which is cool. I mean, you go to these operations, they're state of the art, amazing technologies, but there hasn't really been the focus on what I consider the core raw ingredient, which is seed. Many years I spent in the seed industry prior to joining Unfold. I was actually head of Bayer Vegetable Seed R&D. As we at Bayer were looking at it when I was back with Bayer, we recognize that, you know, you can have these amazing operations, but if you don't have seed that's really optimized for your production system, it's just tough to really get the kind of value out of your farmers that you need. So we were looking at trying to start internally some efforts in focused on vertical farming. And we kind of came to the conclusion, sometimes the best option is to do it externally and to start a new company. And so Temasek became involved, and Bayer and Temasek combined to launch Unfold about a year and a half ago. So I went from heading a roughly 800 person R&D organization at Bayer to being the only employee of Unfold. So 6 hours later, it was a heck of a transition, Amy, as you can imagine.
But wow.
I did it because I think this is such a cool sector. And I do think what Unfold brings is that 100% focus on delivering solutions for vertical farming. As a startup, of course, it was great to start with the $30 million that we launched with between Bayer and Temasek. But the other piece of it, which was really attractive to me, is we have a license to the Bayer germplasm for vertical farming. And so that's really cool because, you know, Bayer, of course, is a leading provider of seeds for vegetables, for open field, greenhouse, glasshouse, and that's the program I headed. My head at R&D. So I was obviously very familiar with it, but I think in order for vertical farming to really realize its full potential, you need entities that really are going to focus on it 100%. And so that's what we do. We're trying to provide start off with a lot of screening, looking at materials that might work, and leading into the breeding programs, but then combining that with the digital crop management tools. And I'm sure we could talk more about that, because I do think for all of agriculture is trying to digitize and try to think about how do we use those tools. But I do think vertical provides a really unique opportunity. So that's the genesis of Unfold, for a year and a half in. The normal ups and downs of a startup, but we're making great progress. And I think it's been well received by the industry that, you know, seed is a critical piece, and to have an entity that's 100% focused on delivering solutions for vertical farms, I like our position.
So tell us about the Innovation Partner Program and the things you're going to announce at the Indoor AgCon.
We looked at, I think, in all of agriculture, and I think every company looks to, how do you collaborate? How do you know? No one is in a position anymore where you think all the solutions are going to come from your own internal R&D, and Unfold is no different. So we wanted to really, put a stake out there and say, we want to collaborate. We want to have partners that can really help us. And I do think for vertical, especially, we have the vertical farms have amazing environmental control systems, amazing ways to grow their crop. But forging partnerships with them and the genetics so that we can help deliver the kind of seed that's optimized for their production systems. I think it's exciting, and that's what we're doing. So, you know, we now have the program up and running. We've had some great initial work with multiple partners and all across three continents now. And so we just wanted to put it out there that we believe in innovation. We also believe in collaboration. And I think this partner program is a great example of how technology provider or seed company can really work closely with the customers and with the growers to come up with solutions that really benefit the individual farmers, but also benefit the industry as a whole.
You're barely 2 years old, this company, it sounds like, right?
Yep, year and a half. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So not even 2 years old. But I mean, if it's backed by Bayer, you kind of have the best of both worlds.
Well, there's a reason why, and I had an amazing experience in 30 plus years, but there's a reason why I jumped at this. I mean, I think that's why I really think about it. We really do have the best both worlds. You know, starting off with $30 million is awesome. Don't get me wrong. There's not, you know, for a startup, it's great, but having the ability though to leverage the germplasm from Bayer. Bayer is, even their competitors would say, it's a leading provider of great genetics. So the ability for us to then use that, first of all, to find products that might have immediate use for our customers, but secondly, to really become the source material for our breeding and genetics program. Because as we get into this trialing and testing program, it's really two purposes. One, can we find some materials that work well under complete controlled environment? And that's great. Let our customers, you know, take advantage of that. But also it's the learnings from that to say, okay, here's the genetics, here's the pedigrees, here are the parental lines. Let's get started on now taking the next generation, which will have even improvements, because now you can really start to test and really develop seeds specifically for the challenges that vertical farmers face.
Yeah, I can't help but jump ahead to what I was planning because of where you just let off. You said the challenges. What if you're a solutions provider, what are the challenges that you're working to solve with vertical farming?
And if I'm thinking about vertical farming, I think that some of the advantages of it, why there's been a great level of investment in it is, first of all, the hyperlocal element, you know, the ability, because you think about the basic breeding equation, which we've all lived by, genotype or genetics by environment, by management, G by E by M, because you're growing indoors, the environment piece is very well controlled because your M, your management is exquisite. I mean, they have great tools to manage that. So it allows you then to focus your genetics on that performance within a very prescribed environment. You're also eliminating a lot of the stresses that a lot of growers face, whether it be biotic stresses like insects and pests or diseases, or abiotic, you know, weather extremes, differences. You're reducing dramatically some of the biotic stresses because you're indoors. You still have to worry about disease pressure things, but much reduced some other types of systems. But then the environmental piece, it's just a dream because you can now say, okay, I don't have to worry, is it going to be 30 degrees at the start of my season, 100 degrees at the end of that season, it's going to be whatever temperature you dictate for the course. You're going to determine the humidity. You're going to determine the lighting. You're going to, you know, put all those factors in place for the entire crop cycle you have. So that gives you a huge benefit. So that's what it is. But then also, because you're controlling that environment and it's indoor, you can get really close to where your end customer is. And right. So the ability to have that hyper-local production.
Reduce carbon footprint. Yeah,
right, exactly. It reduces, and you know, you're not shipping. You're also getting it to the consumer more quickly. You're not shipping 3,000 miles, so you know it affects shelf life.
Fresher,
it de-risk your supply chain because it's indoors, so you're not worried about it's a bad week or bad.
Yeah,
you know all. You know,
especially during this time period. Yeah, the
supply, exactly.
Shorter the supply chain is not just environment; it's also for getting the product.
as we've all learned in the last 2 years, we've all learned how important supply chains are, no matter what you go to buy these days, right?
Yeah.
So absolutely. So I do think there's still a lot of inherent advantages, which is attracting the kind, you know, levels of investments investing.
Yeah.
But it's not without its challenges. I mean, you think about, you're not utilizing the best, the greatest source of energy in our solar system, the sun, right? I mean, you're having to create that energy, having to use energy to do that. So, so energy costs are huge. Second, you know, you're building high capital structure facilities. And so you've got, when day one, you've got a capital load that a lot of growers would not have, right? And so you've got to worry about your cost of goods, both on your real estate, your capital, and on your energy. So that's what we think about. Well, how can genetics help that? Well, there's a lot of ways, actually. One thing, these are tend to be very rapid cycle crops. Most of the veggies that are grown in vertical right now are leafy greens, microgreens, but they're rapid. I mean, you know, 25, 30
they're green.
Days.
Yeah.
They're getting through their cycles very quickly.
Yeah, yeah, they've said
genetics
that.
Genetics help? Well, if we can get varieties that mature quickly and uniformly, and so that you can get those in and out harvested, you save a couple of days. Well, you're saving energy. You're getting more cycles per year. You're really helping to address that COGS. If we can provide genetics that convert light to biomass, energy to biomass more efficiently, because that's the basic equation of how a plant grows, right? Then you can again reduce their energy costs. So COGS is one of the things we're addressing is if you think about where the costs are for vertical farm, what can we do, you know, as far as speed to maturity, as far as biomass accumulation, as far as conversion of light to biomass? Those are all agronomic traits that can help them address their costs. Because right now, you know, they're being competitive at a premium price. You know, most of those come in more the organic kind of 30% premium, but you know, they need to continue to work on that because they've got a large capital load that they're working off, right?
Yeah.
The energy piece as well. But then you can't ignore the top end too, which is how do you help them with the genetics that give that differentiated product at the consumer level? You know, how do you have something that people really want to buy? And you look at a lot of what vertical farms grow, tends to be nice medley mixes, you know, the salads that are right there for you to open it up, put your dressing on, you're off and running. You know, it tends to be that kind of premium market. But a lot of consumers are attracted to that. You know, you're not producing, you know, the bulkhead lettuce, you know, that Salinas and other places do a great job with. It's really a more premium market with the mixed leafies and things they're growing. But I do think we can talk about this more. We have to go beyond leafies. We got to get into crops.
Yeah, that was the wondering if your plan is to help companies expand beyond leafy greens.
It's got to be because, I mean, as you well know, if you look at where the glasshouse industry and greenhouse industry is, you know, it's crops like tomato, pepper, cucumber. It's high value, but also crops that you really can differentiate at the consumer level. You know, the sensory profile, the flavor, all those things are so important, which is why, you know, there's some great glasshouse and greenhouse growers out there, but there's limitations.
Right.
You think about Ontario, you think about Mexico on the greenhouse, Southern Spain on the greenhouse side. Dutch glasshouse is legendary. And these are great growers, but they tend to be really localized, right? I mean, they're in very specific regions that then provide out to the broader geographical region. The advantage of vertical is if we can get fruiting crops in cities, get fruiting crops being grown where the urban populations are, I think that's a huge advantage. So for us, we've got lettuce and spinach to start with, but we also got tomato, pepper, and cucumber. And so for me, we're really going full bore to say, how can we now provide the great sensory profiles that you find in a really great glasshouse tomato, but now put it in an architecture that allows you to grow it in a vertical farm, you know, and really allows you to have the kind of production that's amenable to all the robotic harvesting, all the rapid cycling, all the things that vertical farms do now with leafies. If we can get the genetics that give you the sensory and consumer profile you want, but then are actually cost effective to grow in a vertical farm architecture, we think that's going to be our winner. We're putting a lot of emphasis into that.
Yeah, I think the tomato is the real, what do you call it, canary in the coal mine. I don't know.
It's a home run,
real marker, a flavor.
Home run in the baseball market. Right? No, and you think, and the other one is berries, right? We've all had these.
And berries. You can really tell the difference.
Tomatoes. Oh, you have amazing tomatoes, and then in the same thing with berries, some amazing berries, and maybe 2 weeks later, something in the production side, and it's like, that wasn't the way. And so I think berries is the other one that vertical farms are facing. We don't have any deal on that yet, but we're certainly thinking about berries as an opportunity as well. Because I think it shares a lot with kind of the history of tomatoes, which is people want to eat them all year. They want to have that same quality. They remember going out in their backyard and grabbing that tomato fresh. They want to have that experience 365 days a year. And the glasshouse can get you there, but as I say, it's more regionally localized, and still there's times of year where it's not optimal. Whereas vertical, when we really are able to unlock that and have that same quality every day of the year at a cost-effective delivery, that's going to be a real winner for us, we believe, and for the whole industry.
Do some of these vertical farm ag tech companies, they have their own R&D departments, don't they?
They do, but it's more, I think, analogous to... It is R&D, but a lot of it is really testing and trialing materials and working on the environmental controls and what are the parameters that really are going to be optimized for those, which is, we respect that. I mean, that's really what, in many cases, that's your secret sauce, right? I mean, that's what they feel is their competitive advantage. What we like to do and we like to get out of this collaboration is tell us, as you trial our materials, how do our genetics perform in that? Tell us how we can improve whatever characteristics we're looking for, recognizing that there's going to be things that they're going to want to do within their farm because they have certain ways to do it. But if we can help them, for example, let's say we can help them getting a bigger range of temperature they can grow it at, or the humidity is, they can light, you know, the humidity control has to, doesn't be as tight, can reduce their costs and energy costs, et cetera. We think that'll be really valuable. What we've seen from the market so far is a really good response from growers. You know, we have to respect that there's a certain amount of their data that is going to be theirs that they may not share, but there's also data on how our genetics perform that they are willing to share, because it helps them and helps us to really provide, you know, better varieties for them in the future. And that's really the value proposition we're providing is, let's work together, let's figure this out, and we're going to be able to get you better products down the road. Or through the trialing, identify some things you may not have tried before, but actually does work in your current system.
Yeah, are you going to be tailoring your seeds to each company in their own environment? Because they all have different growing processes, right?
They do, but I do think, one, if you take a step back from it, what they share is, you know, if you boil it down to the essentials, which is basically temperature, humidity, lighting, you know, even though they may have different ways in which they're controlling it, and they all, you know, that's really what they're have developed, is a pretty exquisite systems to control that. But in the end, there's just a subset of environmental parameters that are really important. So if we can go in with our seed and say, here's the temperature, here's the humidity, here's the lighting, they're going to have to adjust it for theirs, but they'll be trialing the materials while we're actually doing it in our system too. It gives them a huge head start. Because I know when I was with Bayer, we were trying to provide materials, but frankly, the testing we'd done was probably in Salinas for lettuce in Salinas Valley or the deserts of Arizona, right? And here, try it, right? Which is fine. It's good. It's good lettuce, but it hadn't really been through it. So in our internal systems, we're going to be, you know, basically replicating a vertical farm. We will have vertical farming capabilities to actually test the different parameters and then come to our customers with, here are the conditions if we grow it, here's how we, and then of course they'll test it as well, and then you'll reach an optimized way within their production system. So it's not necessarily honed for any individual, but it's respecting that it's got to work in their system. And I think because we're going to at least be controlling the same parameters, i.e. temperature, humidity, lighting, et cetera, it gives them a pretty good head start that they haven't had in the past.
Do the tomatoes need to be shorter for vertical farms, the tomato plants? Because it's vertical, so you can't do as many. How does that work?
There's a couple, let me think about tomatoes, there's a couple of different models. If you think about it, as you well know, the greenhouse or glasshouse, it really is a vine type, you know, and you think about some of these 7 or 8 meter glasshouse, those are big vines, right? You know, there are a couple of vertical farms now growing vine-like tomatoes. Not on a huge scale. You know, it's not a big market, but I think they're doing it to kind of get into the market, and also they're learning, and it also allows them to go beyond their current crop portfolio. My belief is we're going to need different architecture. I think we're going to want, you know, especially in the snacking types, tomato has moved so dramatically towards snacking types. That's where a lot of the really great quality is, and that's where a lot of the glasshouse growers grow it. But I think if we can use the power of the genetics we have access to, which has great flavor, great sensory, but now get it in a plant architecture that allows you to grow it in a more rapid rate at a smaller architecture that allows you to really use the structures they have, which are, it's a misnomer a bit to call it vertical. It's vertical, but it's actually stacked horizontal growing planes. You know, it's actually, you know, you've seen them. So it's, yeah. So we need to find, we need to get that tomato into the type of architecture, but retain the quality that you have in the vine type, but then in an architecture that really will be much more amenable to the way most vertical farms grow at this point.
So it might be more cost effective or quote unquote easier to shape the tomato seed than rather than build taller indoor ag companies.
That's right. And that's, you got two choices, right? And you know, if you're gonna go the other route with the vine, there's a lot of great vine tomatoes that are out there. And so we are certainly going to test and trial with companies that want to go that route. But I think that's sort of an easier translation, because what you're doing there is basically using artificial light to replace what you're doing in a greenhouse or glass house, right? Which then they're already supplementing with artificial light, you know, in the Netherlands, other places.
So, yeah.
I think that's an easy, but I do think the big winner long term is actually going to be a different type of tomato that has the quality at the sensory side that you currently have with the greenhouse, but in an architecture that works and is much more amenable to the way the rest of their operation is structured.
Yeah, you mentioned snacking tomatoes. I'm interested in snacking produce. Do you see that in other kinds of produce, or is it just specifically greenhouse tomatoes, or indoor or vertical tomatoes are the, like the cherry or the grape or?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a trend. I mean, I've been in ag for 30 plus years, but I've been in the produce side for the last dozen plus. You know, that trend towards snacking, whether it be, you know, the baby carrots, you know, whether it be the smaller peppers, the smaller it's real. I mean, people like to have, and it's great because in the end, you're competing for stomach share, right? And so the easier you can make it and the better you can taste it, that's the best thing we can do to improve people's nutrition. If it's easy to eat, if it tastes good and it's like, it's there, that's the way you need to go. So I do think there's going to be more and more opportunities for us to think about the convenience side of things. And it's not just tomatoes. I see peppers are going the same way. Mini cucumbers, you're seeing it in too many different produce types, but it makes sense because then plus lifestyle wise, it's the way we eat now, right? It's not, you know, we don't necessarily do all the things we used to do. And if we can make it convenient for people and taste great and accessible, that's a home run.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but consumers that I know are juggling a lot of things at once.
Especially the last 2 years. It's a lot of juggling. Totally agree.
So if you can just grab something and it be healthy and delicious at the same time.
Because it's all stomach share, right? It's what you're going to put in the stomach.
Stomach share. I like that.
Yeah.
So speaking of share, what about how are retailers receiving these products and its market share among other similar items?
You're starting to see it. I've been a lot of time on the East Coast with family, and you're seeing some of the vertical farms like Bowery being in some of the grocery stores here, which is great. Right now, vertical in the grand scheme of produce is not huge. You know, right. It's a few billion probably it's $1 trillion plus industry, right? It's on fresh produce. So it's a small scale, but you know, people are projecting this. Barclays came up with the number of 50 billion, for example, as the market opportunity for vertical. And I do think that expansion of crops gets you an expansion of market opportunity. So that's why I think what we're trying to do on the bridging to the fruiting crops, we're really important to grow that. You know, you're not going to be, you know, it's this is not about, let's we're not going to replace all the Dutch glass sauce. You're not going to replace Salinas. There's going to be multiple inputs into supply chains, but having local solutions that provide really fresh, good, high quality produce in urban areas, that's going to be a market that's going to be attractive. And I think it's going to be viable play. Two other markets I'd like you to think about, Amy's. The second is, you're seeing these come up in urban areas, right? In the US, Asia, Europe, et cetera. But you're also seeing a very distinct effort in certain countries who are thinking about how can we use this for our domestic food production. Countries like Singapore, which have a lot of capital, very, you know, very sophisticated electronics industry, but they have very little arable land, right? And so for them, vertical makes total sense. The Middle East, where you have, again, a lot of capital, they want to be able to stabilize their internal domestic production because there's also political instability, supply chains, et cetera. So for them to make investments in vertical, and you're seeing a lot of vertical farms being built there, again, makes total sense. Another one we're getting a lot of conversations about is the UK with the move with Brexit, all right? Because you think about where veggies come from in Europe. The Netherlands, of course, is a huge producer. Southern Spain for the time in the Netherlands isn't as productive. So for them to be able to now have more domestic production, and again, highly sophisticated produce in the retail industry there, you know, of course they have a lot of agricultural and also digital kind of capabilities. It's another place where these things are going to mature. And then the third big market, which really hasn't matured yet, but I do think has a huge opportunity, is how does this become a more integral piece of existing supply chains within retailer, conventional, and e-retail? What I mean by that is you can think about scenarios where you know, you put vertical farms co-located with your distribution center or your fulfillment center. And so your supply chain is basically driving it across the parking lot. Or in China, there's operations now where it's actually attached to the fulfillment center for your e-retailer. So they literally produce it, package it, and send it right to the door. That's a lot less mature than the first two markets I've talked about. But I think that there's just enough conversations going on in that. And there's enough ways to be thinking about this. It doesn't have to be where, you know, these retailers are kind of sourcing it from all over. Or do they have programs that actually are focusing right on where their distribution centers or their fulfillment centers for an e-retailer? And I think that's a really exciting possibility because, and again, you're not going to replace their existing supply chains, but if you're de-risking it, you know, for them, risk is the biggest thing in their supply chain.
You need options in case.
Yeah, give, exactly. And so if a weather event occurs, well, you got production you know you can count on for your, especially for your more premium products. Every day of the year, you know you're going to get it and it's right there and you're going to ship it right out. And so at least you have, it's putting some stability in their supply chain. And for a lot of retailers, that is huge. That's really what they do. They're logistics companies in many ways, besides being produce or food retailers. So,
yeah, that leads me to me, as well as some of my colleagues have noticed in the physical store where people are shopping at retail stores, that some have little areas where they're actually growing the in-store, like vertical farms or in-store other kinds of farms. Does that affect, like, that's kind of one version of what you're talking about is the future and then a larger scale, much larger scale for e-commerce, to DC.
But it's sort of a first step toward that, right? And I think that you're hitting on something is there are some distinct markets that have already evolved. One are what a lot of the growers are doing right now, which is they're getting pretty large chunks of capital coming in and they're building these 50,000, 100,000 square foot warehouse kind of structures and they're being suppliers to major retailers. Another one is smaller individual chambers that people are buying that are much smaller scale, but allows them to provide it directly to local restaurants or maybe to a local, specialty kind of retailer. But the other one is in-store. And there are definitely vertical farm operators who are targeting that big time to say, you can actually have that experience. The consumer actually sees the produce growing and they're actually buying it as it's being grown in your store. And so it's just a permutation on that. And I do think all those are different. They're viable. They're different. And again, the more options we have in our supply chains, the better off we are. And I do think it's a different kind of consumer experience when you're going it right into your store and there you see the lettuce you want to buy and you see it growing right there. It's like, oh, that looks really good. And you know, it's fresh because literally it's being grown right there.
Yeah. Can companies, whether they're retailers or the growers, the vertical growers, or if they're the same entity at some point, can what you're doing affects how they deal with inventory management and ordering better to reduce excess and shrink
And I do think that, you know, the hyperlocal people think about as a great advantage at a consumer level, which it is, because anytime you can get your product from harvest to the consumer's kitchen, eliminating days there will help you on shelf life. But when you think about it from the supply chain standpoint and that perfect order kind of thing, where if you want the right time, the right quantity, the right quality, well, when you're controlling all the environmental conditions, again, it's about de-risking, right? And so if you're taking the environmental risk out of there, that can get you a long way there. So yeah, absolutely. And I do think the other thing I think it's going to be interesting to watch, especially on the e-retail side, it's almost like there is no such thing as conventional retailers anymore. Everybody is e-retail, right?
Yeah,
there are very few companies that don't have
their e-commerce division or whatever.
Exactly. You know what I mean? There used to be two, but it's not really. It's really a one world. But I think even the e-commerce, I think one of the cool things that can happen out of this, and I think vertical can help on this, is really that designer experience where instead of walking into a store and say, oh, there's a medley of lettuces I want. Well, what if you just go online and say, I want this, 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 and then the vertical farm actually produces it because you now have an e-retail experience that allows the consumer to really select, here's what I want. And then that is what is packaged and sent out to you. Or I want this combination of tomatoes with my lettuce, whatever. And then that's produced and comes right to your door. You like that, huh? So, but that's a different kind of consumer experience down the road. But I do think that combination of having hyper-local production linked directly to the consumer and then an e-retail experience that allows you to be more custom in your choices, that could be a really cool model. It's not really happening yet, but I do think down the road that's something that, that could happen. So
you mean like the consumer could kind of create their own medley?
Why not?
Like you go to a Chipotle, except it's a set, you know, you choose your own right in front of you, almost not in front of you, but you just be like, I feel like baby watercress with a little bit of a cherry tomato and a sprout.
Why not? You know, that's, you know, this is not there yet, but
it's call it like, you know, Amy's salad.
Right. That's right. Instead of having the brand, it's Amy's brand. No, exactly.
You can name it. No, you name the variety or the medley.
Right. No, but if you think about, as you know, as we really get much more mature in how e-retail works, and we mature really harvesting to the specific needs of customer bases, you know, there's all kinds of opportunities. It's, you know, right now that's cost prohibitive to do that, but you can imagine whenever you can bring production closer to where the customer is, and as e-retail matures, those are the kinds of things people are thinking about, right? So, which I think is cool.
Well, I heard it from you first.
we can all dream, right, Amy? What the heck?
So, yeah. Is there anything else that specifically maybe the at the end of the supply chain that people who work with that might be interested in hearing? Buyers, retail buyers or other people, produce managers?
And I think it gets down to because I think one of the advantages of indoor that's going to play out, and it is already playing out, is, as I say, anytime you de-risk your supply chain, if you can get that. And also, it's not just supply, it's quality too. You know, when you're controlling that environment and you know that it's going to look the same, it's going to taste the same, it's going to be the same volumes every day consistently, that's huge. Because I know that, you know, all the work people try to do, you know, using pretty advanced kind of analytics on looking at how the crop is maturing, looking at it, trying to predict what's our distribution going to be on sizes of tomatoes or sizes of peppers, et cetera. If you can say, look, we know because we're controlling the environment, we're going to have X amount of large, and know exactly the day these are going to harvest because you're controlling the environment. That's huge for retail versus for produce buyers. And huge for the retail sector to plan accordingly versus having to have so many backups to, you know, well, if I don't get it from here, I'm going to get it from here. And I got to, and then for the grower too, that's huge risk because the price difference can be tremendous depending upon what size it ends up or what quality and what the ratings are on there. And, you know, for vertical, they're dictating basically what that end product's going to look like pretty darn tight, you know? And so that helps on the produce buyer side for sure.
Great. Well, this is fascinating. Thank you for sharing with us.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the time and always happy to chat.
Hey everyone, that wraps it up for us today. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you hear on this Tip of the Iceberg podcast, take a moment and hit that subscribe button, rate us, and type out a quick review on whatever platform you use to listen to Tip of the Iceberg. And enjoy our earlier episodes. Last week, we talked with Matt Schwartz of Afresh about using traditionally center store artificial intelligence for the fresh departments of the supermarket to better manage inventory and ordering. And the week before, Shay Myers of Wahi Produce shared his perspectives on the glitches in freight and distribution delays affecting retail, plus social media's importance to the industry. And we'll have more of those great conversations from the industry about every week. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you learned something useful and inspirational. Talk to you next time.